Good evening. Come on in. We've got some books here in the back for people as you come on in and just make yourselves at home. It is such a joy to see so many dedicated parents and educators here in the audience with us tonight. You braved storm winds, thunderbolts, rush hour traffic, and early nightfall to be here, all in the service of aiding a small and often misunderstood group of children, the highly gifted learner. But for many of you in the room tonight, Nashville weather is probably the least of the obstacles you face in that task. My name is Elizabeth Schoenfeld, and I'm the director of Vanderbilt Programs for Talented Youth, which along with the Nashville Public Library is bringing the Julian Stanley Lecture Series to you. There are a couple of people in the room who've been instrumental in making this idea become a reality. Kim Bundy, who heads up our parent education outreach efforts at Vanderbilt Programs for Talented Youth, right back here. And Elise Adler, who is the Research and Special Projects Administrator of the Nashville Public Library. They have worked with great enthusiasm and grace to put this series of lectures together for you. And I want to say Elise also is the one who's responsible for making sure that we have a collection of books, that the Nashville Public Library has a collection of books on gifted children and gifted education. Some of those books were brought downstairs, and you could just check those out as you leave if you would like. So thank you very much, Elise and Kim. So just thanks. I'm just so thrilled. It seems particularly fitting that tonight's speakers are the ones to inaugurate our first Julian Stanley Lecture at the Nashville Public Library. Although Dr. Stanley is best known for his work at Johns Hopkins University, well, as you know, there's always a Nashville connection. Few people know this, but Julian Stanley, one of the foremost researchers on the subject of talent development of mathematically precocious young students, started his academic career teaching at Peabody College, and then later on at Johns Hopkins, Dr. Stanley began the study of mathematically precocious youth. This 50-year longitudinal study now continues today on the campus of Peabody, co-directed by Camilla Benbow, Dean of Vanderbilt's Peabody College of Education and Human Development, and by David Levinsky, Professor of Psychology. Now, I'm going to allow Dean Benbow and Professor Levinsky to tell the story of their involvement with the study and their relationship with the extraordinary Dr. Stanley. But if I may, let me tell you a little bit about our speakers. Camilla Benbow has a long and illustrious career in the field of education, and particularly in gifted education. In addition to acting as co-director of SMPY, the study of mathematically precocious youth, Dean Benbow founded the Vanderbilt Programs for Talented Youth in the year 2000, and this is one of those programs that you're here at tonight. Just last year, the dean was appointed by the U.S. Secretary of Education to the National Mathematics Advisory Panel. And even more recently, Dean Benbow has been appointed by President Bush to serve on the National Science Board, which oversees the National Science Foundation. Professor Levinsky also co-directs the SMPY. He is always researching new ways to try to quantify intellectual capabilities. And some of his more recent efforts include the measurement of spatial and visual intelligences. Professor Levinsky is one of many contributors to A Nation Deceived. I think many of you have received a free copy of that. And if you haven't, please do get one on that back table as you go out. For his many contributions to the field, the National Association for Gifted Children last year named David Levinsky the recipient of the Distinguished Scholar Award. Help me welcome Dean Benbow and Professor Levinsky.
Okay. What we're going to do is I'm just going to start, and we're going to present some findings and some of our work, kind of to whet your appetite. And then at the end, we'll open it up and you can do some Q&A. You can ask any questions that you want. But I just thought we'd set the stage, and then we'll go wherever it takes you. So I decided to view our topic today about an issue of equity and excellence. Really, when you think about our country and how we view giftedness and education for those individuals at the other end of the scale, it always seems to be a zero-sum game. It's either that we value excellence or we value equity. But we don't seem to say we can have both. And really, as I say, we really need to have both, because what is the meaning of excellence without equity? And again, what's the meaning of equity if you don't have excellence? You need to work on having both. But unfortunately, as you will see from the story that we tell, it is something that that's a concept we haven't grabbed hold on yet in this country. But how many people recognize this? Yeah, a lot of you. It's been the 50th anniversary, and what is it? It's Sputnik. Now, why do you think I put Sputnik up there? Well, the last time that this country got really worried about math and science education in a big way was right after the Russians launched Sputnik. And we got very much afraid that the Russians were getting ahead of us. And as a result of the launching of Sputnik on October 4th, 1957, massive efforts were launched in order for the United States to catch up. Of course, one of those was to put a man on the moon. But in order to put a man on the moon, you had to have a very strong educational system and a research base. So as a result of Sputnik, all of a sudden, there were lots of classes for the gifted form. And in those days, what they did was tracking. Most of the classes that were formed as a result of Sputnik were classes that sort of started maybe in the 7th grade, perhaps in the 5th grade, and you just stayed with that class all the way until you graduated. And those classes were formed on the basis of IQ. That's how they grouped them and put them together. There were lots of curriculum writing projects at that time, and so some of you and us, and I remember, actually had the curricula that was formed in the early 1960s as a result of Sputnik. Did anyone have any of those, remember those sort of series? It was really a wonderful time for math and science education. But, you know, if you think about Peabody, one of the big names of Peabody is Hobbs. There's even a building named after him on the Peabody campus. And I just thought he kind of captures the tenor of the times back then. He basically said the complete counselor will also be asked to help in the development of new generations of people trained to levels commensurate with their abilities. We've been prodigal of talent in America, being content to let lie fallow or refuse to cultivate much of our human potential. But things were changing even before the launching of satellites, Sputnik, and gifted children, after years of neglect in education, are all the rage. One cannot but welcome this change in attitude, though we suddenly see in teachers' magazines and popular periodicals altruistically toned articles stating the case for the gifted child. We should recognize that this sudden interest in intelligence springs from concern with prospects for national survival. I would hope that our complete counselor will be one of the most effective people in identifying talented youngsters and in helping to plan educational programs to ensure their fullest development. I would hope that too. Of course, today it isn't national survival. We're not afraid of the atomic bomb or being bombed by the Russians. Now what is it that we're all worrying about, and why are we focusing on math and science education so much? Economic viability is about, are we economically competitive? But I think if you read that quote 50 years later, you could have just said economic survival, and you know what? It pretty well describes the times, doesn't it? The more things change, the more they stay the same. So there was, as I mentioned, lots of activities in the 1950s and the early 1960s. And if you ask scientists today about those times, they'll say it was those classes that had made all the difference for me and how I chose a career. And as a matter of fact, in our country, we had the highest rate of people majoring in the math and sciences ever in the 60s. So all that effort did have impact. But then the pendulum swung. And now we had the Great Society. And we started worrying about those kids who came from challenging backgrounds, who weren't learning in school. And those kids deserved our attention, no doubt. But unfortunately, we pursued that agenda as a zero-sum game. And as we tried to equalize educational opportunities to make sure that everyone had an opportunity for a good education, what we did was to dismantle all the programs for gifted children. It's a pretty common story. So that By the end of the 1960s, there was hardly anything left from all the activities in the 50s and early 60s. Perhaps a few scattered enrichment programs in schools, but that was it.
Well, then started the Julian Stanley era. And I picked these pictures out because this is actually Julian Stanley when he became a faculty member at Peabody College in 1949, and that's his faculty picture. And so I just wanted to put a face to this legend. And if you see him over there, that's David and me, a little younger versions of us, but we haven't aged that much. But there we are with Julian when he retired. So at the beginning of his career and at the end of his academic career. Now, Julian Stanley, and tell you a little bit about him. He grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, right outside Atlanta. And he himself was a gifted child and had graduated from college at age 19, became a chemistry teacher. And as he said, I was a pretty lazy kid. And I wasn't very motivated. And just to get a sense of who he was, of course, just as he had been teaching chemistry for a while and business, math, and anything else that the school asked him to do, World War II erupted, and he was sent off to the Chemical Warfare Division. And he said he was out in Algeria, and he said he has never been so bored in his life. I guess he should be thankful for that. But he was so bored that by the time he came back from World War II, he, all of a sudden, boredom stimulated him to really achieve highly. He came back and on the GI Bill, went to Harvard, got his doctorate, came to Peabody, and was just raring to go. But always, he kind of remembers those days when he was a kid in the schools not being very stimulated. So he started off a career in educational measurement. And anyone who's in psychology or in education probably remember him by at least one publication. Every graduate student has to go through a chapter called Campbell and Stanley Experimental and Quasi-Experimental Design that was published in 1964. That's probably his most famous contribution, but he was a big measurement guy. And then, at the end of the 60s, there's a book called Educational Measurement that's a classic in the field. And he was asked to write a chapter on reliability, test reliability. And he wrote a doozy of a chapter. I had a study as a graduate student. And he said, by the time he was done with that, he said he was so sick and tired of dry bone methodology that he just wanted to do something else. He wanted to work with people. Well, just as he was at that point in time saying, I am just sick of this stuff, I need to do something a little bit more meaningful, and he was in his early 50s. All of a sudden, there was this instructor in the computer science department. And her name was Doris Litke at Johns Hopkins, and she had a 12-year-old in her freshman computer science class. And he was the best student that she had. And after she finished up, as she was working with him, she said, well, what do I do with him? So she searched out Julian, who was at that time had gone from Peabody from Wisconsin to Hopkins, and said, could you please help me? Oh, Julian, I'm too busy. I can't do that. Well, she was persistent. And so finally he said, oh, all right, to get her off my back, I'll meet with him. And he didn't know what to do. And he said, well, If this young man is as good as she says he is, and he's in a freshman class, I wonder how he would do on the SAT, the test given to 12th graders. You know? So he decided on this, you know, just on a lark, he's just going to give him the SAT. And this young man scored, he's only 12 now, 690. He goes, ooh. Well, that piqued Julian's interest, so he gave him a whole bunch of other tests. And so then he was hooked. And he worked with Doris Litke, and they all worried, what should you do with this young man? He was bored at the regular school. He was the best one in a computer science class. You surely can't put him back in high school. So Julie and Stanley went to the director of admissions at Hopkins and pleaded this boy's case, and they admitted him to the freshman class. Well, Julian thought this was just an aberration, one of those once in a blue moon kind of things. But those of you parents out there, you know that that isn't true. And a mother heard about this, you know, about mothers too. Well, hey, I know this mother, that I have a pretty special young man too. I'd like to see about this. And he says, oh, can't be true, can't be true. The mother insisted, and so after a while, he said, oh, boy, okay, all right. Well, he'll have to take the SAT, okay, and he scored just as well as the first guy. So Julian Stanley made another trip to the admissions office, got him admitted, and they were doing pretty well. But then Julian said, well, I wonder how many more people are out there. How many more of these kids are out there? So, the concept of working with the gifted hooked on. And let me just say, I got a little bit ahead of me, myself, but being that he is a chemistry major, I think you can see why NTD3 kind of fits as a way of capturing his philosophy. Because as he was going at it and thinking about it, just think about this as we go through the talk. Math talent, discovery, description, and development. And he was very interested, you could see that, in talent identification and talent development. But that was his philosophy. And before I go on to talk about the talent search, let me just tell you a little bit more about Julian. And I think if you see these two quotes, you can understand the two sides of Julian Stanley. I think you've all probably seen Browning's quote, "Ah, but a man's reach," and I would always say, "A woman's reach should exceed their grasp, or what's a heaven for?" That was a philosophy that if you worked with Julian, you would hear and see in his writing over and over and again, because he really wanted to hold high expectations for kids. He thought that if you demanded the most out of them, they would live up to your expectations. The other part was, and this gets into the talent search, if you want to make yourself some squirrel stew, you got to catch yourself a squirrel, or else you might end up with rabbit stew, skunk stew, or no stew. Well, you know, if you knew Julian Stanley, he had a very heavy Southern accent, and that was Julian Stanley. But then he had that overlay of this very intellectual, scholarly guy. It was a very fascinating man to work with. But both of those things, one says you got to stimulate kids, you got to expect most out of them. The other one is you got to be clear what you want. He was interested in math and scientific talent, so he started a talent search for math talent. So now how many of you have heard of, say, the Duke talent search, the Duke TIP talent search? Most of you have, haven't you? Well, that actually is an offshoot from what Julian did. Some of you might have heard Northwestern has one. But in 1972, after Julian had worked with these two young men, and he asked the question, how many more math talent students are there? There were no talent searches. So what he decided to do was, you know what? I'll invite kids from the greater Baltimore area to come to Hopkins and take the SAT math test. But, you know, you can't just give it to anyone. So he decided you had to be in the top 3% on your standardized achievement test within your school in order to take the test. And then you come to Hopkins and you take the test. So in the very first talent search, we had 452 seventh and eighth graders come to Hopkins, and people were just stunned to find out that these seventh graders scored as well as a typical high school student did on the SAT. And they had scores of chance at a top score possible. Well, in 1973, he did it again. In 1974, he did it again. In 1976, there was this undergraduate student, me, who kind of, you know, who was decided at that time I was going to be a clinical psychologist, who was taking a course on psych testing, whose professor happened to be Julian Stanley. And he spent so much time talking about his math gifted kids I thought, this sounds fascinating. So I went to talk to Julian Stanley in my senior year. Gee, would you be interested in having a graduate student? He said, sure. But, you know, Camilla, first, help us out with the 1976 talent search. And over to holiday break, here, read all these books. And if you're still interested, let's talk. Well, I read, and I was even more interested. And that's how I got back into it in 1976. But basically, Julian Stanley in the 1970s conducted 6 talent searches. What is so unusual about those talent searches is the concept of out-of-level testing. What we were doing is giving tests that are designed for older students to these 7th and 8th graders. And why? Well, when you are in the top 3% in ability, you really can't differentiate the top 3%. You're not going to say that a 98th percentile child is better than a 97th. There's just not enough discrimination at the top. But when you give the SAT, you now have kids who score from all the way from chance to the top score possible. And now you can see who's able and who's extremely able. And that's what the point of the talent search, to separate them out. And let me say, before we get into the program part, we conducted those talent searches at Johns Hopkins until 1980, and at that time, Julian said, I have shown that it works, and I'm going to work with other schools to carry on the model. So we worked with Duke to help Duke set up their talent search. We worked with Northwestern so they would set up their talent search, and so on across the country, so that there are now talent searches all over the country. We also worked with Johns Hopkins and had a new office set up. Now, as I mentioned earlier on, so that's when you hear about talent searches, think about that man in 1949 who began his career here in Nashville at Peabody. But Julian always said, you know, you can't just identify kids. And one of the frustrations he had with gifted programs at the time was that, you know what, they spend all year trying to figure out who is truly gifted, but by the time they figured that out, they don't have to do any programming. And so they just focused on the talent identification part, but forgot about the most important part. Why are we doing it? So we can develop talents. Now, when he began in the 1970s, the only thing that was out there was enrichment. But he didn't think that was the best way to go. So he broke with the times. And he decided to use acceleration. I've already given you a taste of the two boys that he worked with. But you know, when most people think about acceleration, they think that if we're accelerating the child and speeding up the child. But acceleration is not that. What the acceleration is about is finding out where the child is functioning, how fast they can learn on their own, and then adjusting the curriculum to meet the needs of the child. So we call it, actually, I think it's a much more appropriate term, would be developmental placement. Because what we're saying is, let's look at what the child is capable of doing and place them there accordingly. It's placement according to competence. Now, I put up art, sports, and clothing because, think about it. If you are going to sign up your child for tennis lessons or ski lessons, you don't sign them up for the 7th-year-old class or the 8th-year-old class. What do you do? What do? They usually say, well, let me see what the kid can do. And then we put them in a class according to what they can do. And if you think about the arts, you don't have 7-year-old piano books and 8-year-old piano books. What do? Find out where the kid is, you figure out, and you put them in, and you teach them from there and how fast they go. And you certainly don't buy 7-year clothing on the basis of age. You tend to, especially shoes, you tend to have them fitted. Now, why is it that academics is any different? That's the question he asked. Well, and we kind of felt like, you know, the way schools work now, it's forcing the child to fit into the curriculum. But shouldn't you kind of adjust the curriculum to fit the child? Shouldn't the child come first and the curriculum next? So, he decided acceleration was the way to go. Of course, he remembered being accelerated himself and finding out, you know, worked pretty well for me. The other thing that was unusual about Julian, and if anyone looks back on those times, You know, it would always be parents who wrote him, of course. But he would always respond to the child. And he would always say, I want to please thank your parents for writing to me. And then he would correspond with the kids because he wanted to work with the kids. Because he thought it was really important for the child to take over the role of guiding their education. Because eventually they have to take over the talent development process. And so he didn't, he wanted to work with the kids themselves. It's not like he excluded the parents, but he wanted them to be involved in the decisions being made.
So,
what are the things that he did? Well, we already heard about early entrance to college, and we had, at that time, in the 1970s, there wasn't that much to do in the schools that are available for kids. You know, I put up the advanced placement programs, and you see advanced placement classes in high schools today, all over the place. But in the early 1970s, that was not widely available. So there wasn't much that you could do. You could skip a grade, enter a child into school early, and we certainly did all of that at that time. But since we tended to work in the, starting in the 7th or 8th grade, eventually this question of when you go to college. So when he started off, the first thing he did was send a whole bunch of kids to college early, up to 3 years early. But he also advocated strongly for an advanced placement program, always telling people to go for the AP classes in high school. He also, you know, so you know, International Baccalaureate was just starting out. That was just not very widely available. So that's not up here, but I'd like to say from my own experiences, I worked on a National Academy of Sciences panel, and, you know, the IB is a wonderful program, so I'd just like to put a plug into it for the IB. So I love advanced placement, but IB is a great program, and I know that if that had been available at that time, it would have been part of the model. But the thing, these were kind of, so sending kids to college early, that was radical. It's called radical acceleration. But the other thing that he became very famous for were these fast-paced classes. So after he had identified these kids, he said, well, what do I do with them? Well, he said, if they are scoring that highly on the SAT, well, you know what, sticking them in a regular eighth grade class, I mean, we didn't teach algebra in the eighth grade then, just a regular eighth grade math class must be horrible. So he decided in the May of 1972, he got a great math teacher, and he said, you know, what would happen if we had a rigorous math class where the teacher paced the class after the capabilities of the most able student in the class, and the rest had to keep up. So he did that. He had a class that was called Wolfson 1, and in 14 months, they covered 4.5 years of mathematics. Some kids couldn't quite keep up with it. They covered 2.5 years. Not bad. Well, that worked so well, he did it again, and the same results. Then he decided, well, let's try calculus that way, and he did it with calculus. Now then, he decided that, you know, I'm working with these gifted kids. But what I'm finding is that these kids come in with different knowledge bases. And, you know, what one kid knows in math is different from what another one. They may be able to go through quickly and learn quickly, but they somehow have picked up a lot of math along the way. They don't need to go through it all. So he developed a new model called a diagnostic testing followed by prescriptive instruction model. And what he decided was, let's teach math differently. Let's give these bright kids a test in mathematics, find out what they know and what they don't know, and teach them only what they don't know. And then always use standardized tests to make sure that they have mastered the material. So you think about testing and no child left behind, we already had it back then. So make sure they know it. And it would be really fun. This happens every year. Now, we've been running these classes, and I've been involved in them. And it is so much fun to see the first class with these mathematically gifted kids. You know, up to that point, they have, because of them having needed to do a lick of work to get, you know, to learn the concepts, they already know it. So they had never been in a situation where they've been presented with material that they didn't know. So you can imagine what happens in that first class. All of a sudden, Everybody has been given a problem set of things that they're supposed to work on that we know they don't know because we've already tested them. And then they look at them, the kids, and up goes their hands. And you know what the question? Well, I don't know how to do this. And then the teacher, well, did you read the introductory materials?
Well, no.
Did you work through some of those examples?
Well, no.
Did you kind of look in the glossary to see what these terms mean?
Well, no. Am I supposed to do those things?
Yeah. Well, this is the first time they actually had to learn how to learn. And that is perhaps the most valuable lesson of all. They're learning how to learn for the first time. And, you know, they can learn. These kids can learn a year of math in 3 intensive weeks during the summer if they score around 500 on SAT math at age 13. But if they score around 700, it can do 2 to 3 years of math in 3 weeks. But best thing of all is letting these kids finally struggle with problems. Because what we had found up to that point was that, you know what, these bright kids eventually have their comeuppance. You know, they can go through high school and major in IQ, get straight A's, get into the best college, and hardly do anything. But eventually, they're going to come to some point where they have to study. But at that point in time, they have an identity of, you know, I don't have to do any work to get good grades. And they don't know how to study. And then it's too late. So we want to catch them early when they're still malleable, when we can still help form them. Because you know what? To develop talents takes a lot of hard work. We started off in math. Then we branched into sciences. And so we did the sciences. And what we would do is, for example, take the College Board Achievement Test in biology as a pretest, find out what they know, and then end up. Now, they know a lot, but they do biology, chemistry, or physics. These bright kids, before they even have the first class when we give them the test, you know what they scored those College Board Achievement Tests before they even take in a formal course? They might have read it on the side. They score over 500. That's the average for the class before we even start. By the time we're done, 3 weeks later, their scores are in the 700s. But that's how much they already know. It already shows you how inappropriate the curriculum is. These kids can get such high scores without ever having taken a course. Now, it isn't that they just soak it up, but you know, they're reading, they're doing things, they're working on things at home. So we did that. We went into the humanities as well, and the model worked there. And now then, and I'm going to, before I turn it over to David, and I've probably taken up more of my time than I should have, let me just quickly go talk about, acceleration is a hard sell. People are kind of suspicious when you say, you know, we really think you ought to, you know, move ahead a grade. Teachers are suspicious. Principals are suspicious. They're all worried that God is going to do harm, and that's what they should be worrying about because, you know, you don't want to do harm. Parents are worried. Oh, geez, you know, I don't want to disrupt their wonderful, you know, their lives. I know. I've done this myself. You know, what are the outcomes? And I know exactly how you parents feel because I had a 4-year-old who was pretty advanced in math. And I was hesitant about putting him ahead, and I thought, well, sheesh, I'm telling all these other parents that they should enter school early or skip a grade. I better put my money where my mouth is. I better do it. So I know exactly what you're struggling with and what it feels like down here. It worked out just fine. I can tell you now, my son, 31 years old, is an astrophysicist, and it worked out just fine. But how has it worked? You have here a nation deceived. There's probably no better summary in front of you in terms of what the results are of years of hundreds and hundreds of studies evaluating acceleration. Because everybody is so skeptical about acceleration, it motivates people to do studies on acceleration to show that it works. And it really does. Earlier, Elizabeth mentioned that I'm on the National Math Panel. We're looking at, how should we teach math in this country? What should we teach? How do kids learn math? How should we assess it? But we also looked at gifted children.
surprise, surprise, since I'm on it, I kind of say, we got to look at them too. And we looked at acceleration, and that was something, that is the practice that emerged as a best practice that we could recommend. When you look at acceleration compared to any other option, it has the biggest gains academically, whether it's enrichment, homogeneous grouping, or whatever. If you compare the outcomes, and this is just a simple message, that's where the biggest gains are. If you accelerate a child a year, you gain a year. Other forms of acceleration, it's about a half a year to a year is what you're looking at. You just had an issue in the Gift of Shock quarterly come out about best practices, and acceleration was highlighted there very strongly. The other part is, you might say, all right, I can believe that it might have strong academic benefits, and you have the book in front of you, you can look it through. But what about social and emotional development? Do we harm them? Actually, if anything, it's positive. Slightly positive effects on their social and emotional development. And if you have gifted kids, you kind of see that they tend to like to play with older kids. Have you noticed that? Well, so you're putting them up with great, you know what? You're putting them with kids they like to play with a little bit more. So it makes sense. We had, when Julian retired, and you saw that picture of him, we had a big symposium on Julian's work, and a very big figure in the field of education is Lee Kumbach. He was actually a termite. He was one of the termite study participants. And we asked him to look at the termite data. I don't know if you've heard of a termite. He's just 1911. He's, when these kids were identified and tracked throughout their adult lives. So he wanted to take a look and look at the data of the longitudinal study from the termite studies. And he said, let's look at them 50 years after they were identified. So they were in their 60s. And he wanted to look at, okay, so these were kids who were born on average in 1911. And he compared those who had been accelerated with equally able kids who had not been accelerated. And he compared them on all kinds of outcomes. And he said, I didn't expect to find any effects 50 years later. I mean, the vicissitudes of life, he felt that would have just washed it out. But he said, on every variable that he studied, the differences were not large. But in every case, they favored the accelerates. And you know, to me, it's kind of like, well, what else can you say after that? You know, that's pretty definitive. But I'd like to say that, you know, there is a great value of homogeneously grouped classes, especially if they have enrichment and acceleration in them. Because then the kids get to interact with each other. There's something that gets very special when those kids interact with each other. And it's also very important for them to get to know each other. It's very affirming. So you can look and see that the Fuchs and Fuchs up at Peabody, they looked at, for example, what happens when you put gifted kids together in a group versus when you mix up the gifted kids with some average ability kids. And he said, the nature of the dialogue, you wouldn't recognize it. It's very, very different. So do you just say that, you know, every now and then these gifted kids need time to work together, to get to know each other, to challenge each other. And finally, when we ask the kids when they're as adults, we ask them to look at, do they regret having accelerated? What do they think? What they say as adults is, I wish I would have accelerated more. When we ask them, would you accelerate your own child? They say, definitely. So this is looking back, 20 years looking back, and saying, would I do this to my own kid? And to me, if you would do it for your own child, there is nothing more stronger evidence than that in terms of what they felt about it. So I think this goes on. And I'm going to now transition to David, who's going to talk about our talent development model. And then we'll open it up for questions at the end. But as we switch gears and he gets my stuff, I have here for you a picture of how a star is born. So you can look at here. This is a picture of how a star is created. And what David's going to talk about is how people stars are created. But while we do that, you can watch the star, and hopefully I can get this to work. There you go. That is an actual star being formed right there over thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
And that's the start.
Okay,
thanks for coming tonight, and what I'm going to do is talk about how we conceptualize the individuality of these kids. It's not unlike how we conceptualize the individuality of people in general, and Camilla has expertise in educational and developmental psychology. My expertise are in assessing individual differences in human behavior and psychological measurement. And when I got my degree, I actually double majored in counseling psychology. And I'm going to introduce a model that we used at the vocational assessment clinic that I worked at. And it's a model of vocational adjustment that we have extended to conceptualize intellectual talent and the individuality of these kids. And we find it useful. And it's probably, without question, the most comprehensive model of vocational adjustment in the psychological literature. And I'll put it up now to show you some of the dimensions we use to conceptualize individuality. Camilla mentioned Lewis Terman in his study of intellectual talent that was done at Stanford University in the early 20s. It's probably the most famous longitudinal study in all of psychology. He identified over 1,500 gifted kids, just based on IQ tests, that had to be individually assessed all through the state of California, and he followed them up for decades. First publication based on this study was in 1925, and the last one I know of, the book that came out by Carol Holohan in 1995, continued to follow these kids, and it's just a really incredible story. All they used to identify the kids was IQ. IQ is important, but there's a lot more to cognitive abilities than IQ. In fact, a lot of people don't know this, but Terman lost two Nobel laureates through assessing IQ with the highly verbal Stanford Binet. He lost William Shockley and Luis Alvarez. They were assessed and didn't meet the 140 cutting score on the IQ test. Had they been given a quantitative reasoning measure like the SATM, they would have scored high enough to be identified. So let me just go through this model of how we conceptualize intellectual talent and what we add to it to get a feel for the needs of these kids. Basically, we conceptualize human abilities in three components: spatial mechanical, verbal linguistic, and quantitative numerical. The simple systems that we use to manipulate things in the world. And the SAT, we used the SAT to identify kids, and that was Julian Stanley's genius to look at specific abilities. And we do a very good job of assessing numerical abilities and quantitative reasoning and verbal linguistic abilities. We don't, as of yet, do a very good job of identifying spatially talented kids. In fact, we've gone way beyond the term by using verbal and quantitative reasoning abilities. But we lose approximately half of the top 1% in spatial visualization. Spatial visualization is critical for careers like in engineering, architecture, many of the creative arts, and the physical sciences, being a dentist, an orthopedic surgeon. So nowadays, with modern talent searches, we're probably not losing the Shockleys or Alvarez's, but we're probably losing the modern-day inventors like Edison and Ford. Basically, the theory of work adjustment is conceptualized by two dimensions. Can you do it, and do you like it? That's what's critical. And what we do to identify kids is we assess their verbal and quantitative reasoning abilities, and we know from past research what scores are required to take various courses, and we tell them about their potential. But that's only half the story. We can do a lot of things that we don't like to do. I'm qualified to be an accountant, but I wouldn't enjoy studying the subject matter or working in those areas. There's nothing wrong with being an accountant. I just wouldn't enjoy it. I much prefer psychology. So what we do is we assess their preferences, their interests in scientific areas, artistic areas, social areas, enterprising areas like business and merchandising, office work, and working in the outdoors. People versus things, idea versus data, and we've done studies now on the interest inventories, the values inventories that a lot of you probably have taken in high school. We've got, hey, you know, these kids, we're taking and giving them the SAT. How about these high school interest inventories? Would they work on these kids? And lo and behold, we have done 15 and 20-year test retests on conventional interests and values questionnaires, and they correlate significant enough to use them. Now, we're not trying to pigeonhole these kids. We're just trying to give them some rough guideposts about their individuality to see how they might like to tailor their educational development. So the theory of work adjustment says you need a correspondence between the abilities and the ability requirements, how fast-paced is the curriculum going to be for the child, and you need a correspondence between their interests and the subject matter that's going to be used in the classroom. Acceleration is a choice. We don't make kids accelerate. They typically choose, and when they choose, they have to choose what areas are they going to take an AP course in, what areas are they going to take a college course in, or a course in a local community college. And basically, we have found that when you couple ability assessments with interest assessments, you maximize what's called satisfaction and satisfactoriness, and that helps you predict tenure or how much you enjoy the environment you're placed in. Educational environments ultimately evolve into occupational environments or where people work. Now, let me give you just the outline of our study. We are currently tracking over 5,000 intellectually talented kids. They're in 5 cohorts. The first 4 cohorts were identified by talent searches. Kids who scored in the top 3% of conventional tests routinely administered in their schools are given the opportunity to take the SAT. And we have 5 cohorts. Our first cohort was identified, as Camilla said, in the early 70s, and they represent the top 1 in 100. Kids who are the top 1 in 100 in either verbal or quantitative reasoning. In the late 70s, we identified approximately 800 kids who were in the top 1 in 200. So kids who scored around 500 on SAT, verbal or quantitative, were placed in that group. In the early 80s, cohort 3, our most able group, are in the top 1 in 10,000. These are kids who scored 700 or more on SATM or 630 or more on SATV. This is before the SAT was recentered, before age 13. Now, Camilla has talked about the differences that come about when you're in the top 1 in 100 versus the top 1 in 10,000 in terms of learning rates. They can learn more than twice as much. But how do these differences play out in the real world? Do they make a difference? Well, in the United States, approximately 1% of the population has a doctorate. They either have a PhD, an MD, or a law degree. 1% of the population. Kids who, before age 13, are in the top 1 in 200, 30% of them have doctorates. Kids who are in the top 1 in 10,000, over 50% have doctorates. Moreover, if you take a close look at these kids, they're doing different things. First of all, they're more likely to be in the top 10 universities in the country if they're in the top 1 in 10,000 group. Approximately 22% in the top 1 in 200 are in the top 10 universities in the country. Twice as many, 42% approximately, of the top 1 in 10,000. The top 1 in 10,000 group are also publishing more. They're creating more patents. So there are genuine outcome differences that come about from these differences that are assessed at age 12. We have another cohort that we identified when we were at Iowa State, on the Iowa State faculty, 1992-1997. These are kids who are in the top 3%. We're tracking them. There's a subset of this group who are also in the top 1 in 200. And then finally, Cohort 5 is a different group. They weren't identified by a talent search procedure. They were identified as first and second year graduate students in the top math science training programs in this country. What we did in the early 90s is we wrote to the chairs of the top math science training programs, MIT, Caltech, Harvard, Stanford, and we asked if we could survey their students. And we gave them comprehensive questionnaire. So one of the things we asked them is we explained what a talent search was, because even in the early 90s, they weren't as prevalent as they are now, and asked them if they would have qualified in the seventh grade, and only 8% said that they wouldn't have qualified. So we know that we have a pretty good model. We asked the schools to give us as many females as they had and were willing to sign up as first and second year graduate students, and then give us a random sample of the same number of males, because in math science areas, males are overrepresented, and we wanted to make some generalizations based on sex. So of that 714, about half are females. Now, we have conducted 20-year longitudinal follow-ups of Cohort 1, Cohort 2, and Cohort 3, and we've done a 10-year follow-up of Cohort 5. All these cohorts are in the mid-30s when we follow them up, and in 2 years, we're going to do our first age 50 follow-up of Cohort 1, so it's a very exciting time. And I'd just like to give you some data to give you a feel for what these participants are doing now. Now, it even takes psychologists a while to get their arms around this when I say it. So I'll give you some examples. When we say that someone is in the top 1%, that doesn't tell you much. I mean, it tells you something important, but the top 1% covers one-third of the range of ability. It covers about one-third of the range of height. It covers more than one-third of the range of weight. Think about it. IQs for the top 1% come about approximately 137. But IQs go beyond 200. I don't know what the cutting score for weight is for the top 1%. 270 pounds? Well, people weigh over 1,000 pounds. And height, 6'3", well, people are over 9 feet tall. The question is, do these differences in the top 1% make a difference in the real world? Okay, well, for our first two cohorts, what we did is we compared, now they're all in the top 1% in quantitative reasoning, though. We compared the bottom quartile, bottom 25%, with the top 25% over 20 years on a variety of outcomes: earning a doctorate, income, earning a patent, earning tenure at a top 50 U.S. university, Now, the top 25% of this group had an SAT average of 620, okay, before age 13. The bottom 25% had an SAT average of 455, again, before age 13. Look at the difference in earning a doctorate. And STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. There's a significant difference here, too, for technical doctorates. Income differences, what proportion had a median had an income at or above the median of the entire group. Earning a patent, the base rate for patents in this country is about 1%. The bottom quartile earned patents at 4%. The top, close to 8%. These are differences that make a difference. And how about earning tenure at a top U.S. university? Over 3% versus less than 1%. And you hear about abilities are important for grades and stuff. They're also important for real-world criteria. Now, I'm going to show you some data from our most able cohort, the top 1 in 10,000 group, and those graduate students that we identified when they were in their early 20s, early mid-20s, and we followed them up 10 years later. Now, there are all kinds of ways to define success, and we look at a lot of different things. Income is one way. Earning a doctorate is another way. They're, you know, contributing to the community. There are a lot of different ways. Here are two important criteria for success. Academic success. Do you have a tenure-track faculty position? And occupational success. How high is your income? Now, as you might imagine, graduate students in the top math science training programs in this country, it's not surprising that over 20% of the males and about 13% of the females are in tenure-track faculty positions. Okay? But look at the kids who were identified before age 13 on the basis of a
tuition. May I have your attention, please? The library closes in 20 minutes. If you have books or other materials that need to be checked out, or if you need to register for a library card, please make your way to the service desk on the first floor.
I'll get you out in time. Look at the top 1 in 10,000 group in tenure track position. And here are the ranks. So when you look at tenure track positions at the top 25 U.S. universities, there's no difference, or the top 50, between kids that were identified by a two-hour test and graduate students in their first and second year in the top programs. Look at income. People who make between $100,000 and $250,000 a year. Again, we just conducted this study, and this is when they're in their early 30s. Income between $250,000 and $500,000, and income above $500,000. The top 1 in 10,000 group. Huge. Now, we're just using ability level here. How about ability pattern? So that was important. On this graph, what we did is we just added up their SAT scores on the y-axis, and that's ability level or general intelligence, and then we subtracted the SATM from the SATB, which gives you a feel for how balanced an individual's profile is versus how tilted it is. So people in the middle here are very balanced, equally able in quant and verbal. People over here are much more able quantitatively. People over here are much more able verbally. And look what happens to PhDs in the math sciences and humanities. Here are the math sciences They're higher, and they're more quantitative. Here are the humanities. They're higher, and they're more quantitative.
Here are tenure track positions. And here are patents and literary accomplishments.
Patents, literary accomplishments. So these ability differences at age 12 result in meaningful outcomes at age in their mid-30s. I'm going to quickly go through this because I haven't talked about spatial ability. We've been writing a lot about how this is an underserved population. And what I'm going to show you, we have over 500 kids who were assessed in the mid-70s on, in addition to the SAT, spatial visualization. And I put the SATM on the x-axis and the SATY on the v-axis. And arrows to the right represent high levels of spatial ability relative to the group. Arrows to the left represent low. And you can see people who, for their favorite high school course, assessed 5 years later, they're high quantitative, high spatial, relatively low verbal. Here are humanities and the social sciences. High verbal, relatively low quantitative, relatively low space. Here's 10 years later, their four-year degrees, same pattern. And here's 20 years later, their occupations, same pattern. Spatial ability is an important variable. Now, in addition to abilities, we assess vocational interests. That refines the predictions, but it takes more than interest and ability for high achievement. If there's one widely agreed upon finding, no matter who you talk to in the talent development literature, is capacity for work, time on task, persistence, zeal. That's very, very important in determining who really excels from someone who just achieves highly. And we ask our participants in their mid-30s, how much do you work? How many hours do you work? And look at the range. How many hours would you be willing to work if given your ideal job? Regardless of the exceptional, look at the people who are campaigning for president now. Not one is working a 40-hour work week. Podorowski, the great Polish pianist, was being interviewed. He was told he was a genius, and he said, yeah, and before that, I was a drudge. He practiced 10 hours a day for years. You know, athletics, music, earning tenure at Vanderbilt, earning partner at a major law firm in Nashville, it's the same process. And what we do with all of these individual differences, attributes, abilities, preferences, capacity to work, is we build these constellations that differentially tune people to different environments where they're more likely to thrive. We feel differently as we move from domains that involve poetry to engineering to architecture to the social sciences. It's because of our individuality. These are stable features of of our individuality that we go through life with, and they have important implications for telling us the best ways to structure our educational environment, our occupational environment, and opportunities for optimal development. I also think that they differentially structure what we attend to in life on a moment-to-moment basis. What we see, what we don't see, is based in part on our individuality. And here, you make contact with William James, who says, millions of items of outward order are presented to my senses which never properly enter my experience. Why? Because they have no interest for me. My experience is what I agree to attend to. Only those items which I notice shape my mind without selective interest. Experience would be utter chaos. Think about it. Think about watching with 12 friends a thrilling mystery movie for a three-hour movie, and you're in the last 15 minutes, everyone's at the edge of their seat, you're glued to the television, you're going to find out who killed whom, and you can hear a pin drop in the room, and one of your friends types up, "My goodness, how could that guy wear that tie with that sport coat?" That's an aesthetic eye. That person can't tune it off. I have a colleague who was riding in a boat on a beautiful summer day with her husband and six-year-old daughter. The daughter was in the front of the boat saying, "Make the boat go faster, Daddy, make the boat go faster." My colleague was enjoying the aesthetics of the lake shore, and her husband was commenting on its economic development. What environment are they in? They're in the same environment, but they're differentially tuned to different things. And our individuality tells us what we should be differentially tuned to, what we're most likely to excel in, what we're most likely to be passionate about.
We won't go through these, so we can have some questions. So if there are any questions before the library closes, we want to give you a chance. We promised. Yes. You know, I think it depends on their competence level. You know, when a child is really, when their child's capacity, it's always relative to the context. If the capacity of the child is way ahead of the classmates, then an adjustment needs to be made. It's whenever that happens. You know, just because, say if you're using IQ, just because a child has 137 IQ, is in the top 1%, if they're in a special school where the average IQ is, say, 130, there probably doesn't need to be much of an adjustment. So it really depends. You could be 120 IQ. If the average IQ of that school is 90, well, then you probably need to make some adjustments. So it's all relative. I always think about it. Think about the basic. Where are they performing? Where are the rest of the kids? If it's way out of line, an adjustment is needed. Yes? Well, then he needs to be advanced. He needs to be put up into a higher grade where he will be challenged and will be learning. And, you know, you can keep stimulating him on the side, but if you don't make an adjustment with the grades, eventually all that extra enrichment is going to make him even further away from the classmates. So, you know, I think I would demand, if I were you, that, you know, he better be put into a higher grade where he will be challenged and will learn something. It's not your responsibility to take him out and homeschool him. Yeah, well, he needs to be tested in his capacities, but you can also very well show that if he can do the third grade work, then maybe he needs to be in third grade. You don't need all that testing, too. You can just look at it, where are they performing?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, we do have a couple people here that can talk specifically about Metro after we get finished with questions, if you would like to come in.
They know you from a reading kid in the high school 16. They said this child will not be made to 16.
Any other questions? I don't think they want to be locked in. All right, well, thank you very much.